Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
Sunday, remember the 5th of November, gunpowder, treason and plot. Storm Ciarán has battered the south of England. I've been in Stockholm this week, so experienced some snow already. Very nice city to visit, so efficient and clean. How's your week been, Kev?
It's been great. I've been in the Mediterranean Sea every day, swimming and exercising. It's been a low of 26 and a high of 31, so sorry about that.
Couldn't be probably any different from the weather here and the one that I experienced in Stockholm then, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, and as I said before, I'm probably only 450, 500 miles of the crew flies from Gavin. So
yeah.
What the two different stories going on there? It's crazy.
Yeah, mad to think that one. So as I said, the news story is dominated this week by UK bracing for a soggy bonfire night as the Met Office issues a yellow warning for heavy rain on Saturday, with the southeast expecting thunderstorms and coastal areas anticipating 30 to 40 millimetres of rain. Europe faces the aftermath of Storm Ciarán with 12 deaths, widespread flooding and thousands of UK homes powerless. Over 70 flood warnings are in place across England, Wales and Scotland, and while the storm has left 150,000 UK homes without electricity, 11,300 remain cut off. In Italy, Tuscany locals are confined at home after torrential rains led to flooding and vehicular damage. Did you see Dominic Cummings this week? Did you read anything about that? He appeared at the COVID inquiry.
Just the headlines, which were basically saying that was he saying that Boris Johnson was basically saying we'll choose who dies or something like that?
Yeah.
Maybe that was a bit sensationalized, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he made a lot of revelations there. He basically, he read his testimony, didn't he, at the COVID inquiry, revealed a mix of personal distraction and political chaos at number 10. He recounted Boris Johnson's preoccupation with writing an unpublished Shakespeare book amid personal turmoil, including a divorce and his girlfriend Carrie Simmons' spending on renovations. Cummings depicted Johnson as downplaying COVID seriousness, as you just said, likening his attitude to the reckless mayor in Jaws, and even claiming Johnson wanted to meet the Queen despite having COVID symptoms, potentially risking her health. Yeah, there was a lot of revelations came out, and I don't know if you saw it, but they had to issue warnings on the news, live news articles here, because of the swearing in the messages on the WhatsApp. It was literally C-bomb, C-bomb, C-bomb. And Sky News, obviously, they couldn't edit it out because it was a live broadcast. You know, they went straight to the hearing there and literally had to put a banner up saying, we apologize for any explicit language on there. So destroyed their swear filters. But very interesting, really, to see what really went on and these exchange of messages. But I thought Cummings came over quite well. He was pretty much just stood there and said, yeah, I said all these things, because it was an absolute horror show the way it was being run. He described Boris Johnson as basically flip-flopping. One day he'd have this stance on it, and then the next day he'd change his mind and do something. He said it was chaotic, basically.
Yeah, and the Tories are going to pay the price, I think. Now I'm more sure than ever we're going to have a Labour government next time around.
Okay, so let's move on to our first guest this week. Today we're joined by Charles Archer, long-term FTSE AIM investor and freelance financial analyst, working with various platforms, including IG Index. You go by the Twitter X handle at ThatStocksGuy. Welcome, Charles.
Hello, how are you? What have you been up to today, Phil?
Well, obviously prepping for this podcast, and I've just actually got back from Stockholm. I was doing some work out there in Sweden, so I was just saying to Kev earlier, I experienced my first snow of the year. Well, probably there may be some in January, February, but certainly of this latter part of the year. So a nice bit of snow in the air. Love Sweden, love the efficiency of the Swedish. Everything just works. It's, you know, it's not too busy. It's people are very nice. They speak fantastic English. I don't know if you've ever been, but just love Sweden. I love Scandinavia. Full stop.
Well, so do I. One of my largest clients is based in Sweden, and yeah, really, really great country. Not that many people there. Amazing strawberry cider. What more do you want? It's perfect.
Strawberry cider. It's not that the Copperberg. What's it called? The one. Yeah, another one.
Recorderlink.
Recorderlink. Yeah.
Brilliant. Try and find the local ones if you can. But yeah, I mean, to be honest, it's just alcoholic Ribena for grown ups. But you know,
something like Kev. Kev needs this, don't you, in your life?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, my morning so far is, because Friday here is Friday's the weekend in the Middle East, bit of a late rise, and we had breakfast with the guests that are staying with us here, and then I went for a nice walk, and then got to the beach, and then went for a nice swim in the Mediterranean, which was absolutely like a lake, not a ripple on the water. 31 degrees here, so nice and warm.
Well, I went swimming this morning for a couple of hours and local pool, but what they've decided to do, as you'll know if you've ever done lanes, you have the slow lane, the fast lane, and the medium lane. And I've only ever swum in the medium lane, but they for some reason decided over the past couple of weeks we don't need a medium lane anymore. So half the pool is slow and half the pool is fast. So you go in and it's either Michael Phelps going 400 miles an hour or a bunch of pensioners on the other side. Yeah, and then kind of you're kind of in your mid 30s, I'm like in reasonable physical condition. But I'm not the best swimmer. I prefer kind of running and cycling, but my knees and hips are starting to give out. So I'm swimming instead, and now I have no idea what side of the pool to go for. So yeah, I'm with the pensioners today, sadly.
I like that. Say go in the slow lane and just swim over the top of them. That's good fun.
Well, wow, I don't know.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about your background, Charles, and your investing journey? And what you know, because obviously we see you on Twitter and you make some really, really interesting articles, and we'll reference one of them in a minute. But just tell us about what your involvement is with the AIM and FTSE markets.
So yeah, sure. I mean, I was originally a full-time employed financial analyst for the first few years at university. I found it kind of boring because I have a personality, and when you're in an office, you're not really allowed to have one of those, sadly. So I went into recruitment instead, self-employed, and I found that super fun right up until I had my first child. And then if you've ever been in recruitment, the hours you have to put in is just, it's not realistic. It's not possible. So I got out of that as quickly as I can. I kind of fell out of that actually because I was recruiting for a role as a freelance writer at like this really small outfit. And I thought, this is something that I'll be able to do. I've done my analysis before. Am I going to be any good at writing? I don't know, but I can give it a go. I did. And then, yeah, I was really successful. And after a couple of years, put together quite a few kind of big name clients. Some of them still under NDA, sadly. But even now, so for the past 2.5 years, I've been writing, covering like the blue chip stocks for IG Index. I work with ShareTalk and UK Investor Magazine and Investing Strategy and a couple of others covering the AIM shares. And my basic philosophy, as it were, I would have liked to keep my name out of the limelight. And a lot of stuff that you read, you might have read a lot of my stuff and not known that it was me. It might not have my name attached to it. But in sort of the kind of the start of this year, when ChatGPT started to take off, this is when I started to worry, or maybe it was last year, I can't remember. I feel like it's been around forever, but it started to worry me a bit, because I do think that generative AI is going to replace the kind of writing I do for blue chip stocks pretty soon. So now I've created, you know, kind of an online online persona for Twitter, where, you know, I'm putting out all of the kind of small cap stuff that I write about. And it's that kind of stuff that I don't think that can be replaced by AI technology, because these small cap companies that I look at, a lot of them are not very well researched. And the ones that are, the problem with the research, as you'll know, is that it's generally paid for, you know, in company shares. And I've written a fair few research notes as well. So, you know, the problem is that there's no real way for a small cap company to get the kind of coverage it needs without paying for it. And then obviously that creates, you know, bias. And when I looked at the AIM market, I thought, well, I can, you know, write as much as I can, do whatever I want, and it will be super fun. And then, yeah, I mean, I've been investing in AIM shares for the past sort of 5 years, 6 years-ish. And then some of my earlier calls have done really well, particularly in the lithium space. And now, essentially, I'm just writing as much as I want for as many clients as I like, and trying to make money while I'm doing it. And obviously there's two elements to that. The first is investing in the shares, and the second is doing the writing. And it's been going pretty well so far.
So, I mean, you obviously just alluded to that you've been investing for about 5 years. Do you want to tell us how you think the markets have changed in the last sort of, let's say, since the COVID crash, and then obviously what we saw, what we witnessed within those sort of 6 months to probably 1 year after COVID was kind of, you know, made an appearance, and how the market is today, and also where you think the market may go in the coming sort of months and years?
Sure. So, I mean, we'll start with the pandemic crash. Obviously, the markets between sort of mid-February to like the 20th of March 2020, I remember the exact day, everywhere the global markets collapsed by a third. So a third of the wealth in the world gone overnight. Obviously, it's not actually gone. But I think it's a really important investing lesson, is that, okay, if you're invested in like a blue chip stock, if you held onto those shares and waited kind of 6 months later, they then went on to kind of record highs. If you're at that bottom of the market where, you know, everything in the world has lost a third of its value, anyone who had the bravery to buy shares at that point generated profit, regardless of whether it was blue chip or commodities or small caps, you made a lot of money. And then, but obviously there's a negative side to that, because if, for example, you started investing in kind of like April or May 2020, the bottom of the crash, and a lot of your investors started investing then because for the first time ever, they're sat at home with furlough money, not having a job without much to do. You then have this scenario where anything they invested in went up for the next year or so because you've got all of that pandemic cash. And that's where you saw like the GameStop short squeeze and the AMC short squeeze, which was really fun. But actually, the problem is, a big problem, I think, that a lot of investors found is that they made loads and loads and loads of money from between sort of mid-2020 to kind of October, November 2021. And then the Bank of England increased the base rate from 0.1% to 0.25%. At that point, I was writing a lot of articles about how the FTSE 100 would massively outperform the S&P 500 over 2022. And everyone was kind of saying, no, that's not possible. It never has before. It doesn't. And I was like, no, because the FTSE is filled with oilers and miners and banks. And when interest rates rise, they tend to do quite well. And those tech stocks on the US side don't do very well. And obviously they didn't. So you had a bear market for the NASDAQ, the S&P 500, the FTSE actually rose by 1% in 2022. And now we've come to this situation where we are now. So the base rate's at 5.25%. I think it's probably still got a little bit further to rise. But the point is that the interest rate is really high. Now, if you're a retail investor and you're looking at like, okay, I could put money into like a blue chip stock, or I could put money into like a bond and get 6-7% return, or I could put money into an AIM share, it's very difficult to justify putting money into a small cap high risk stock when you can get like a 7% return without, you know, any risk whatsoever. And you can do that tax-free in some ways as well. So obviously the AIM market has massively corrected for that higher rate of interest because money has just come out of risk assets. My perspective is that as the interest rates have come close to a peak or potentially even have peaked, you've got a bottom of the market, because now what's going to happen is, if you look at the Bank of England analysis, they're saying that the base rate is probably going to stop. It's going to stay high, but start falling gradually over the next couple of years. And as the interest rates start to fall, the attractiveness of risk comes back in, and then the valuation of all of these companies is massively decimated. And so, you know, you don't even need to talk about one company in particular. If you look at the AIM market, it's fallen by 50% over the sort of past 18 months, hasn't it? And yes, it's been rising very slightly over the past week or so. I think we're at the bottom, or very nearly at the bottom. I can't see how the market can fall much further. If you look at like the pandemic crash, I think the AIM market went to kind of 620 points, and I think it's currently at sort of 680, 690. So the pandemic crash is the lowest it could possibly go, I think. So if you're talking about trading on technical analysis or doing like really short-term investing, then you don't know where it might go. But if you're talking about investing over the next 5 or 10 years and really promising shares, that where you have allocated risk money, where you're comfortable that if something goes wrong, you can lose that money, then now would be the time to invest, I would say, in many of these companies, with the caveat that things can always go wrong.
Interesting take on it. I didn't really think of it like that from the interest rate point of view, but it makes perfect sense. So in a way, you hear this word unprecedented come along, crop up a lot in media, and you know, that it seems to be the buzzword. But do you think it was almost a perfect storm during that time when people were furloughed, you know, the pandemic had hit, there was, you know, C-bills loans, small business loans and bonds being paid to cut to people. So people had kind of more disposable income, interest rates are low, they had money to gamble with. Do you think we're ever going to see anything like this again? Or do you think that was a complete like unicorn scenario?
Well, I mean, there's two things, you know, that I find really interesting. The first is that Brent crude, which is like the benchmark for international oil prices in the North Sea, that went negative for the first time ever. You can argue the technicals, but it went negative in April 2020 for the first time ever. That's never happened before. So if you're, you know, obviously this didn't actually happen, but in theory, you could have been paid to take oil.
Yeah, I remember all those big tankers that were mooring up, and they weren't even coming in because they were like, well, we don't know where to put it.
So I mean, obviously, and then obviously the other problem with it is that if you're operating like, you know, there's a lot of small cap oilers, and they'll understand this, but obviously on a much bigger scale, if you're like BP or Shell or Exxon, if you stop mining oil or gas, it is an absolute really expensive, I'll use the word ball ache, to try and get the plant back up and running. You know, getting any kind of rig up and running is not going to happen. So they had to keep pumping stuff out. So that's the first thing. That was unprecedented. That's never happened before. So when you say unprecedented, obviously this word is overused in the media a lot. But in that particular that particular case of oil, yes, unprecedented. Now, the second thing that was unprecedented, I would say, and it's kind of related to all of this money sloshing around, is that you have this massive, massive push of people going into investing. And obviously that breeds innovation. So I write for IG, and obviously it's a regulated environment. And IG have been around for decades. I think they're the largest CFD broker in the UK, as far as I know. 18,000 instruments. It sounds like a pitch, but it's not. But I have a point here. The point is that you had 30 or 40 new investing apps get created and brought online during the pandemic, ranging, and some of them might have been around a little bit before, but they massively.
Robin Hood was one of those as well.
Robin Hood and eToro and, Wealthify. And, I'll plug it in here that I write for Investing Reviews. We do a podcast and we interview a lot of these CEOs of these newer apps. And the point is that this second cut, this is unprecedented. You've got this massive democratization of investing where people who previously, how can I say this? So between 2008 and 2021, interest rates were kind of below 1% for sort of 13 years, right? So if you're a little bit older, like me, sadly, you'll remember when you used to get a return on cash in the savings account above inflation. Now, for anyone kind of in their 20s or kind of early 30s, they've only known an environment where they put cash in the bank that loses value to inflation and not getting a return. So now you come up to this kind of pandemic era where they've got loads of extra money and plenty of people. I know the pandemic was like a horrible time emotionally, but plenty of people, once you've got further money and no like transport costs and you're prevented by the government from going to the cinema, you've got a lot of extra cash. So you'll be able to like invest for the first time ever. And you're not going to put that extra money into like just cash because you're not going to get a return. You're investing for the first time ever and you're getting a massive return. And if in AIMShares, for example, you can put money into something and then like into a company and then it goes up five times and you think, wow, I'm really great at this, even though I've got no analysis, it's just gambling, really. Whereas now you've got this situation where the interest rates have risen. So now you can think, well, I can put money in a bank account, but actually, the base rate is 5.25% and inflation is still 6.7%. So if you put money into a cash account to get a cash return, you're still not beating inflation. It just feels like you are. And therefore, you're far better off still investing in equities. And then obviously the question is, which equities? If you look at the S&P 500, that's being pushed up by the Magnificent Seven. It's just AI stock. It's just a huge bubble. And it's going to start deflating really soon. If you look at the FTSE 100 companies, the FTSE just provides those dividends. So that's kind of a 4% return every year. But again, you're not beating inflation. My perspective is, if you're in your late 50s, early 60s, and you're approaching retirement, this is not a good strategy. But if you're younger and if you have an appetite for risk and if you have a little bit of extra money, the AIM market is a super fun way to generate much higher income than you can get anywhere else. Now, the thing is, though, what I would say, there's a few caveats there. The first is, and I'm not tooting my own horn, but I have a higher, discretionary income than most people. So I can tank that damage if I, have a bad investment. Not everybody can. The other thing is that it's my full-time job to kind of analyze these kind of small cap companies. And you can only get so much information into an article. So if it's a company like Breitling Gold, I know you guys cover, I did a kind of like a long form piece on that company, which kind of like tailored to a retail audience as kind of like an introductory piece. And it was really, really, really popular. That's maybe sort of 5% of what I actually know about the wider company. You can't get all of that information out. So the AIM market is a really, really fun place where you can make loads of money. And the third point is, this is what I forgot while I was rambling, that if you are kind of like the average person earning sort of like 35,000, maybe 40,000 a year, and you've got like $5,000 left to invest, if you put that into an index tracker like the S&P 500 and you get 10% a year, that's not going to be enough to change your life. That is the sensible thing to do. And this is not financial advice, this is just, my opinion. But if you want to actually, get enough money to put together a house deposit relatively quickly, if ever, then you've got to take significantly more risk. And that's just my perspective on it.
Charles, I was looking at your website scenario and you were saying that you go down the line of investing in the SIP, and which for anyone who doesn't know, self-invested personal pension plan with the tax breaks, and then obviously the ISAs, and then you move on to EISs if you have, and tax, and you have the available money. But you did say that in your SIP, you were willing to ride the S&P 500. Now, yeah. I think at this moment in time, that's a pretty foolish decision.
Fair enough. And plenty of people do. So you're not alone in it. Yeah.
So and maybe it's only a foolish decision in the short term, as in the next 2, 3, 4 years, because longer term, will the American economy bounce back and continue to move? Yes, I think the dollar is in trouble as well. So give us your thoughts on that. I mean, that's something I've been rambling on for a year now. You know, I do think the dollar is massively overvalued, considering the way they have, you know, an incredible
deficit.
And a deficit that's growing. So in other words, the debt's only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and faster and faster and faster.
Yeah.
With high interest rates.
They have huge, huge problems in America, but then so does everybody else. You know, so you have to decide where you're going to put your money. This is my theory on it, right? Okay, so in the ISA and then in the general investing account and the EIS, this is all kind of like this is money that, for me, for current me or for me a few years from now. Whereas when I'm looking at SIP investing, sort of 20 years or maybe 30 years, depending on when you decide to cash out, that's kind of like half my disposable income goes into the SIP. It tracks the S&P 500 and I can forget about it. It means I don't have to research it. I just put it into that index fund. Now, my rationale for it is because I'm investing over a multi-decade timeline and not sort of the next 2 or 3 years. Since 1957, the S&P 500 has returned on average 11% a year. So some years it's dropped 25%, others it's gone up 40%, but on average 11% a year. So every sort of 6.5, 7 years, your investment should double. You know, obviously, past performance is not an indicator of future returns. It's the official line, but realistically, it should. So I'm hoping in sort of 30 years time when I cash it out, I've got a decent pension allocation. And now the key point of this for me is that it frees me up so that when I'm looking at those higher risk AIM companies like Greatland Gold or Avacta or, you know, the ones that I've covered many, many times, if those investments go to nothing, I still have a pension to fall back on. That's the key thing. Whereas I do know...
Because your SIP, if you like, is pound cost averaging, you're putting in the money monthly?
Every month, obviously invoice all the clients, figure out, you know, what my excess, you know, money I have, and then half of it just goes into the SIP and I forget. It's as simple as that.
So now, when you're pound cost averaging, it's a different... I mean, I think people need to understand... When the pound cost averaging and basically dripping the money in, you're going to be buying many more shares if the thing goes down, or less shares when the thing goes up. So you really should benefit from that over the long term, especially if you continue it. But if you have £50,000 or £100,000 and you want to invest it into the market, then pound cost averaging is not going to work for you. You may put it into 2 or 3 tranches, so you buy some and then you wait and you see how things go, and then you buy some more and you wait and so on and so forth. But I think many people invested what they had. So maybe they had a pot, as you said, of 5-10 grand. And if they time that wrongly, even in the right companies, they could lose a lot of money. And at the same time, they could also gain a lot of money. And that is also a significant risk, as well as, you know, the company choices. And I think a lot of people sort of the timing has not been taken into account in terms of how they risk things.
Yeah, I mean, my basic, I'm very, you know, with the SIP, I'm very basic on it. Is the SIP, I'll say to my wider investment philosophy, 5% to gold, 5% to crypto. I'm reasonably confident that all cryptocurrency is a scam, but I'm not confident enough that I want to stay out of it completely. And then, you know, a decent chunk goes into a SIP. And then the rest of it, I revert specific AIM shares. Now, I take your point that if you've got a giant lump sum of money and you want to invest it and you're not able to pound cost average it in, that requires a different strategy. But for me, if you're able to invest, you know, slowly over the long term, every single month, money goes in, I don't care where the index is, just hit buy on the second of the month, then over time, it should deliver a reasonable return. Those American blue chips. Is there a chance that, you know, it all comes crashing down? Well, if it does and it doesn't recover in time for my retirement, then the world's got much, much bigger problems, I guess, would be my...
As a long game, you've got time, haven't you, for it to
recover?
Just like in any pension, if you're probably a similar age, in the late 30s, early 40s, then we've got ride out any kind of...
Well, I mean, this is super important. It's really interesting, actually, because a lot of pensioners who are planning on retiring now are not able to, because the bond market has kind of crashed and a lot of their money was in bonds. Now, you know, anyone would be able to say, oh, bonds are the safest thing in the world, but obviously they are, in terms of you'll get that, you know, you'll get your return on it every month, every year, whatever it is. But if interest rates start to rise and the bonds that you hold become effectively worthless, because anyone wanting to buy a bond can get it cheaper from the source rather than from you. So Yeah, I mean, the problem, obviously, I think what one of my big things, or I do say this to plenty of people who are like coming up to retirement or wanting to retire, is that there has to be a point where you go, okay, well, I've seen a lot of growth in my portfolio. I want to retire. I'm a couple of years away from retirement. I should move everything or a proportion to cash to make that happen. And what
tend or government bonds, which were the thing, but I mean, now they're probably not as, they're too risky now for a lot of people, aren't they? You know,
well, this is the problem, isn't it? Because where do you put your money? Bonds are incredibly, America and the UK and Europe, well, everywhere in the West is too much debt. China, you have no idea what's going on. But it's not looking good. Currencies don't last forever, you know, what regardless of what people say. And so, yes, bonds, I would say, you know, if you're putting money, if you're putting, keeping like US dollars or pounds or yen or whatever, it doesn't, it's not 100% guaranteed. Things can go wrong. If you're buying gold, you might think that's guaranteed, but actually gold is near a record high. So 5 years from now, you know, I think it will stay relatively high because there's a lot of inflationary stress, a lot of geopolitical stress. But actually, when the recovery comes, a lot of that money is going to leak out of gold and go into equities. If you put money into equities, that could go wrong as well. So yeah, I mean, pick your risk, I guess is the question.
Yeah, exactly. None of these things are without risk. Cash is not without risk because inflation affects it. Gold is not without risk, as you say, because it depends on when you buy it as opposed to the current price. Gold is also valued in US dollars. I know it's valued in other currencies as well, but if the US dollar starts to fall, what's going to happen to the price of gold? Is it going to go up in US dollar terms? Who knows?
But who knows?
All of these things are risks that people need to think about, consider. But if you like, we are in the casino part of the market, okay? This is what we do, right?
Yeah.
This is what, you know, so people will blame you, oh, you're doing this or you're doing that, or why did it do that or why did it do this? Well, as you said, these companies are not that well researched.
No.
So I suppose what we try to do as well in the podcast is to at least get some of the information out there. And as you say, you write an article and only put 5% in. Maybe in the podcast, we managed to get 20% out.
Oh, well, 100%.
And then we try and visit the places, you know? So if it's a mine or it's something that is physical, then we've gone to places, you know, we've been to Cyprus, we've been to Ireland, we've been to America for the coal mine. We're off to Rwanda next week. So all of those different things, we hope anyway, helps the investor just to believe a bit more that these things are real.
Yeah. So obviously you wrote an article, we alluded to it earlier on, the FTSE AIM Endgame, 10 Catalysts for Q4 2023. Right. And I recognise, obviously, and know a lot about the majority of the companies that are listed on there. A little bit bemused on maybe how you think that the end game for some could be this year, or maybe I'm misconstruing the article, but you can answer that in a minute. Sure. Some of the favourites on there, and I went through some of their sort of like historical timelines, like for instance, Codal Minerals. Back at the Bougouni was bought back in 2016, funded in 2023, so still, you know, we're talking many, many years and probably still a long way from actual production. Obviously, funding may be announced imminently. Prem was another one, you know, 2017, funded in 22, Greatland Gold, Havieron on Discovery back to 2019. You know, these are not short-term picks, really, are they?
No, but okay, so what I mean by sort of end game is that they are all coming to a catalyst point, right, beyond which they are significantly de-risked, and then you can no longer consider them to be higher risk AIM shares, in my view. Okay. So, I mean, we run down the list. If you look at Premier African Minerals, it's now on the verge of production, right? So if it produces that minimum production at the correct grade, then it will then be able to do that every month thereafter. And then the risk of that company is much, much lower. If you look at Greatland Gold, you've got that mineral resource estimate update, which has been delayed by a year. If that comes in and it's an absolute massive bumper upgrade, you're unlikely to ever see below 10p ever again, right? If you're looking at Horizontal Minerals, which is, you know, one I've only kind of recently started looking at, if they get that funding sorted at reasonable terms, then that share price is going to absolutely rocket. But if they don't, the company will collapse. You know, if you can go through all 10 of them, and the point is, obviously, it's not the end of the story and it's not the end of a company, but Codal was a classic one. And then announced the funding in January, and the share price went to sort of 0.7, 0.8p. It took them, you know, 10, 11 months to actually get that funding, and that's now they're signing the deal in the next couple of weeks. And if you've been invested, you've been told, oh, it's going to get signed this month, this month, this month, this month. And I, you know, in that article, I correctly said it will be Q4. That's what's going to happen. If you look at it, total, yes, I was correct on that one. That is, they are going to get that signature. That's, and therefore, the share price is going to go up, and it has. Greatland, I said they will release a mineral resource estimate update this quarter. I'm certain that they will. Horizonte Minerals, yes. So all of them in that article, they're going to have those catalysts. And then in Q1, either they're going to be much higher or much lower. And not, but they're definitely not going to be where they are now.
Okay, so when you talked about Endgame, you mean there really is a catalyst to change the value of the share in the term?
So, you know, obviously you guys cover Greatland Gold and you interview Sean, you know, Sean Day, CEO, on a regular basis. If that mineral resource estimate update comes in the next couple of weeks, and it's massive, right, like the last two have been, then investors coming in have a much, much higher certainty, because obviously it's a really complex investment case and we can't go over it all here right now. But the point is that if that mineral resource estimate goes much higher, then the asset that you have on the books is much, much better. And one of the issues you've had with Greatland is obviously you've got these hydrological, I wouldn't say issues, but all mines have like water issues, but you've had this, as they've drilled the deposit, have they learned more about it? They found that there's, you know, there's more water than what they thought might have been. So if you massively increase a mineral resource estimate, then that massively improves the investment case of, you know, you're gonna drill in, you're gonna get the gold out of that deposit anyway, but then what it means is that if you have a water problem, it doesn't matter because you've got so much gold there that it's worth dealing with the issue. It makes dealing with the issue.
What do you see, Charles, as a massive uplift? Because I think we're talking about 6.5 million ounces as we speak.
Okay, so you had the maiden resource estimate, right? It was 4.2 million ounces. That was December 2020. And then that went up slightly to 4.4 million ounces in October 2021. Then 6.5 million ounces in March 2022. But you've had 80,000 meters of extra drilling since March 2022. So that's, you know, almost 2 years now of extra drilling without having any kind of update at all. So, you know, if you consider that between, you know, in this sort of 18 months between that initial estimate and like the most recent one, you've got 50% growth in the, you know, in the mineral resource. Is it unrealistic to think another 50% given 80,000 meters? I think it's possible. It might not happen, but obviously if it did, then that completely changes the dynamic. Because then you go from having a decent quality but mid-tier asset to a high-tier asset. I think based on everything that I've read and looked at over the past couple of years, it's all about de-risking the deposit. But I think that when that RNS comes out, it's going to knock their socks off. But you potentially, you know more about it than I do.
No, I don't think we do. But so that's why I was asking the question. You think that that could start with a 9 then, basically, as in 9 million plus?
Or maybe a high 8.
Yeah,
I think it, yeah.
But
I
anything significant is going to make a big difference. 8 or 9, it's going to mean a massive.
Okay, let's follow the money for a second, right? So you've got the $220 million of debt funding from the bank syndicate, and they're very happy, you know, to release that money as and when Greatland wants it. But on top of that, you have Wiley, obviously Andrew Forrest, is just giving Greatland an extra $50 million Australian dollars, right, to continue to drill the deposit. You wouldn't see that amount of money going into Havieron without there being some kind of assurance that it's going to be much bigger. Because if you look at the Grant Samuel estimation of, you know, what Telfer and 70% of Havieron is, Grant Samuel said that would be worth sort of $500 to $600 million. That's, you know, 70% of the asset plus Telfer. And yet Greatland has managed to find $220 million of debt funding, all the extra cash they have as well, and then another $50 million Australian dollars from Wiley. It just screams to me, if there wasn't a massive update coming, they wouldn't get that money. They simply wouldn't have been given it.
Yeah, I agree with you. Okay, so here's the question. We're talking about Greatland Gold, okay?
Sure.
5 years ago, Greatland Gold was worth, I don't know, market cap 5 million, maybe 10 million?
Yeah, nothing. Yeah.
Nothing. I completely, like, in nanocap. Okay.
2 years ago, it went over £1 billion.
A billion. Okay.
Beautiful. So, yeah, sure.
So it's great talking about Greatland Gold, but as absolute aim, stroke, and main market, but small cap, very small cap, where's the next Greatland Gold?
Where's the next Greatland Gold? Well, that's the question.
I have my ideas.
I have mine too. But I mean, okay, I think the first thing to say is that Greatland were lucky in some measures. You know, when you're a micro-cap and when you're drilling, yes, you're drilling in like prospective tenure. And yes, you've got the quality teams. And yes, you think there's gold in the ground. there's 1,000 different scenarios where they drilled in the wrong place and came up with a duster. Like, that does happen. So I think that that's the first thing to say. Nobody, you know, invested at that 5 million point for, oh, this is going to go to a billion. Or if you did think that, you were an outlier. Not many people were saying that at the time.
Yeah.
Now, when we say, where's the next great goal? Where's the next?
I like your comment. You're an outlier. So you're not a nut.
Well, I don't know. I mean, like, to be fair,
call them, you're a nutter. What are you talking about?
Or a charlatan.
Well, I don't know. Like, okay, so you guys will know. I know plenty of companies where they've gone, we've got a prospective asset. We need to raise some money and then we're going to drill it, right? And they've come up with nothing and it's not there. You've got quality people, but it's not their fault. It's just
then. But what about companies like EUA, Eurasia, who announced that there was a suitor and we've not heard anything for 2 or 3 years on that? How does all that work?
You know, I think it's, the problem is that we have, with the AIM market, it's a blessing and a curse. It's regulated through nominated advisors. And nominated advisors are generally paid in the shares of the company they're advising. So there's obviously a problem there. And the issue is, you know, and this isn't, you know, anything against Eurasia. This is just part and parcel of it. You never, as an investor, know the full story until either you're a millionaire or you've lost all your money. That's the name of the game. So Well, when you're looking at sort of like, where's the next Greatland Gold? Where's the next share that's going to make you masses and masses of money?
Charles, I'm going to put you on the spot then. Give us your 3 top picks for the next 18 months. And they have to be super high risk. And
super high risk.
Super high risk with super potential return. Now, yes, we accept they could fall flat on the face. Okay, and everyone has to accept.
You say you drop a grand in on each one, would be full known that you could potentially, that will be gone.
That will be gone. Okay, right. I think the first one has to be Avacta, I would say. For those of you who don't know, and many of you will, Avacta is a life sciences company that's attempting to deliver chemotherapy without any side effects. In the next few weeks, they're going to release data from a phase 1A trial, which could be completely revolutionary in science. And I believe there will be a buyout of this company by a pharma titan relatively soon from now. The flagship AVA6000, you've got patients in the trial who've been dosed with it and they're not showing any side effects on their chemotherapy. And they're being dosed with much higher doses of doxorubicin, which is the chemotherapy drug that you would normally be prescribed. So I look at that company, I think, okay, if they're the flagship asset, it does, you know, actually works. They say it will. But anyone invested is going to make a massive amount of money. But if it doesn't, you're going to lose everything. And those are the only, you know. So when you want high risk, that's the perfect example. Second example, I would say has to be Greatland Gold. I'm going to throw that one out there because you're going to get that mineral resource estimate update. I think it's going to be massive and I think it's going to come very soon. But then beyond that, you've got the definitive feasibility study. And I know it's been slightly delayed, but you're talking to like Q3 and you said sort of over the next 18 months. So I look at Greatland Gold and I go, okay, that's a share where not only do you have a floor value on the price of the share price of about 6p, you've also got the opportunity to make a lot of money. If you invest at 6p, even if you invest now, based on that estimate being, obviously if the update comes and it doesn't blow everyone out of the water, then you might have a problem. But given, again, as we said before, the finances behind it and the fact they're still being given money, it just screams to me that it's a buy. And the third one, if you're going sort of 18 months from now, tricky to know, it could be Codal Minerals. Once they get their deal signed, they're going to get a dense media separation plant online. They've done a lot of drilling, so they'll be producing lithium in about a year, assuming nothing goes wrong. It could be Premier African Minerals. Again, they're meant to be producing now, currently, so you might get an RNS very, very soon, which is very positive. But again, it's all about grades, and investors don't know what the grades are yet. It could be Baron Oil, which I've been covering for the past year and a half or so. Chunich could sell, and there's lots of catalysts coming there. But yeah, I mean, for my money, I would say Avacta, I would say, is probably the best opportunity if you want the highest risk, highest reward, and then Greatland Gold if you want slightly lower risk. And bearing in mind, Greatland's in Australia. If even though the asset is not a tier one asset yet, because it should only make 300,000 ounces of gold a year rather than sort of the 500,000 that Newmont wants to keep on its books, it's in that kind of Paterson region. It's the perfect area. It's something that you want to have. It's, yeah, I don't know. I guess that those are my thoughts on the market at the moment.
But none of those, Charles, and I'm not criticizing you because I agree with a lot of your calls there. None of those are your 5 million market cap that have beaten down so badly that we're now
okay.
We're the 5 million that's going to go to, not a billion, but it could go to 5 million. It could go to 100 million from 5 million.
Okay, well, there's a couple. I mean, it's tricky. It's tricky to know because there's so many. I mean, if you want like a really, really tiny one, Tertiary Minerals, which has copper assets right next to ARC Minerals. So ARC is now drilling with Anglo American. Tertiary has got a couple of assets right next door. So if you want to, you know, put £1,000 on a pump, I think that's one of those stocks which could do really, really well, or you're just going to lose all your money.
Another one. Which country is in Zambia?
Zambia. Yeah.
Okay. You've got... So my 5 million
get me
is African Pioneer, because it has two deals with majors, both in Zambia, and also a mine that's going to come in Namibia, all copper. But the one that is in the north of Zambia is Kolwezi style copper with cobalt, which is stretched over from the Congo. This is potentially absolutely huge. Billions of dollars of copper. Billions of dollars with a market cap of 4.5 million. So this is my call. I really do think in 18 months that stock has got two things, because it's already got the mine in Namibia that's going to happen, which actually will protect its capital base, if you like. And then there's potential with the major.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm going to throw £1,000 in. I'll come after you in 18 months. No foul. But I guess you're jogging my mind, kind of like Marula Mining, I think, where Jason Brewer, who's, you know, I like him, but I know he divides a figure in some said, but I think he's a really hard worker. And they're a multi-asset with lithium and copper and graphite. So, yeah, I don't know. I think there's quite a few kind of plays out there you could go for.
I also like all the metal resources as well.
Well, you know, the thing is, I did a research report into Power Metal, and obviously Power Metal Resources own 62% of Golden Metal. And Golden Metal obviously have got their other assets, but they have Pilot Mountain. And yeah, but I think Golden Metal is kind of like a 10 million market cap, so I thought it was outside of our realm. But okay, basically, yeah, I mean, I'm massively positive on Golden Metal. No, I'm been adding to my position because I think there's going to be an export ban on tungsten from China very, very soon. And when that happens, Pilot Mountain, which is the largest undeveloped tungsten deposit in the United States, is going to get developed using US government money. Now, that tungsten export ban from China is really important because the US Department of Defense is banning imports of tungsten from China to the US anyway from 2026. But that's where the US gets most of their tungsten. China had a ban on tungsten exports up until 2015, 2016, until a World Trade Organization said essentially you have to like lift the ban. But China's now banned most graphite exports and then some critical minerals, some rare earth elements. So tungsten will be the next one to go because China can ban it and it will hurt the US a lot, but it won't hurt China too much economically. So yeah, Golden Metal Resources, it's right in Nevada where you've got, you know, that pro-mining politics and skilled labor and there's water and power. Yeah, I'm 100% on
the
side.
And the other one, which is bigger, okay, which might fit in this same scenario for the same reasons you're talking about Golden Metal, is Sovereign Metals, which has the big rutile and graphite project in Malawi. Yeah. This one, I think, is a majorly undervalued play in terms of what.
Yeah, I mean, if Sovereign was a gold project, it would be about 5 GGPs, basically. That's how big it is.
Yeah, but it's a question. The problem is, again, it's a question. I think it's, it's marketing these companies to investors so that, you know, if you look at Greatland, right? They've done a really good job of marketing themselves as a company. Regardless of where the share price has gone, you have a lot of, you know, obviously roast PR, but also just in general. But then when you're looking at a micro cap, if you look at like Marula Mining, where Jason Brewer is kind of like everywhere all the time, you know, people are going to buy shares because, you know, he's everywhere saying, you know, this is going to work, this can make people money. And this is the problem when you have something like Sovereign Metals. You've got a great asset, but how do you market it to get people to invest in it? Because you might know about it and I might know about it, but the average retail investor going, okay, where am I going to pump my £1,000? They need to.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree with it. I agree with you 100%. And that's one of the reasons why the market in general, in terms of this part of the market that we look at, is so undervalued at the moment. But people are going to search out the value as we go. Anyway, Charles, it's been absolutely fascinating to talk to you. Please come again. Let's do this again. We could talk for another hour at least, I'm sure.
Quite easily. Yeah, yeah.
And let's do it again in the next few weeks, because I think it really helped everybody. And obviously people want to hear what we're talking about when we're talking about XYZ companies. It's very, very useful, I think, for everybody.
Oh, I think, I think, well, no, I'll end it off. I think the one thing I would say is diversification. So with AIM shares, do not go all in on one. I think that's my kind of key thing.
The people that we speak to, we will go, oh, no, I'm all in on this one. And we're like, you can't do this. You've got to have at least five to, we say an optimum maybe 5 to 10 or 10 to 12 stocks or something like
that. I mean, I just like, I'm incredibly bullish on a few of them, you know, as I've said in the podcast, but I have the S&P 500 based set. I have a little bit of gold and crypto. Yeah. And then when I'm looking at AIM, it's not all going on one share. And I do worry that, like, when we're doing podcasts like this, and I've said, oh, I think Avactor is amazing or Greatland Gold is amazing, and I do, that someone's going to put their entire life savings on that. And if something goes wrong, and things do go wrong,
you've got to have safe investments, risky investments. And you've got, as you say, you've got to, you can't put everything into the risky. You've got to have some that are safer, maybe some gold, maybe some metal, maybe some wine, maybe some whiskey, you know, everything's an investment, right?
Yeah, of course it is.
It's not all on black or all on red. This is not a good idea.
No. And yet this is the problem though, isn't it? Because if you're invested in, like, there have been AIM shares that have gone up thousands of percent over the space of a few months. So the problem is, once you get emotionally invested into a stock, you think this is going to be my one. I'm going to be rich.
Yeah.
And it doesn't always happen. But sometimes it does. I think we'll end on that. Sometimes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sometimes it does, and I hope sometimes will be me or you or everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
We all should be winning. So let's hope, as you say, that the market, we are at the bottom, and we see fortunes change in the next, you know, 6 months, 12 months, or whatever it is, you know, going forward. Because as Kev alluded to many times, the market does not seem to be forward looking at all anymore.
No, I think the basic for me is it's at that macro scale. It's once people, and once the interest rates have stopped rising, which they have or nearly are, then the market can settle at the bottom, and then it can start to rise, because people, you know, retail investors, high net worth, it's not even retail, it's the high net worth investors and the institutions will call the bottom of the market. And once they call it, it'll shoot away. And by which point, if you're retail, you've missed it already, sadly.
Very good. Charles Archer, long-term FTSE and AIM investor, freelance financialist. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Charles.
So on to our next guest this week, Luke Sartain, CEO and founder of Narwhal Media Group. Welcome back, Luke. How's things?
Yeah, very well. Thank you, Phil. How about you?
Yeah, all good. Obviously getting over the Storm Kieran and everything that's battered the South Coast this week. I've been in Stockholm as well, as I alluded to earlier on. But yeah, all good, thanks. And you?
Yeah, very well. I've been up and down the country myself and been trying to avoid the storm as best as possible, but I don't think we've had it as bad as some of my investors over in Jersey. So, yeah,
they've had it bad over there, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very good. So in this storm, did you see any narwhals get washed in, you know, from the Arctic?
No, but we are actually talking about doing an expedition into next year. We're going to take a couple of shareholders and...
Absolutely, I'm signed up already. I'm coming.
Yeah, you get your armbands on, Kevin, and we'll see you over there.
That's called fat in my book, not armbands.
Bingo wing.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things was we wanted to get some experiences and get some time with key stakeholders, key clients. And you can either get, you know, a normal hospitality box somewhere, or you can hire a boat and go to the deepest parts of the ocean in search of narwhals. So yeah, believe it or not, we are actually going to do that in the middle of next year. Maybe we should do a little special podcast from on board via yeah, Starlink at the time.
Indeed. Let's do it. So give people an overview of Narwhal, the company, then. What is the situation as we see it now? So what you see, not the future, what you see now.
So Narwhal has evolved over the years. It was actually made up of a number of companies, and we had to consolidate them into one so that it was an easier story to tell for not only the investor community, but for also the staff and everybody who's involved with the company from over 9 years now. And where Narwhal sits now in the universe is our aim is to try and make it as simple as possible for homeowners and businesses to be connected together to, in particular, make those larger purchase decisions when you are a homeowner. So whether that's getting solar panels or heat pumps or that green revolution that we're seeing unfold right now, all the way through to later in life, from funeral planning to pension funds to mobility furniture to stair lifts, and all of these random niche categories where people really struggle to get transparent pricing. You know, these conversations typically involve a sales rep coming up to your home, and we want to try and push that forward and make it a bit more transparent, a bit more friendly. It's something that nobody's really ever done. Comparison technology is typically associated with car insurance and credit cards, but we're trying to bring it to all of these other really, really important sectors which are underserved.
Yeah, and all of these sectors have cash, I presume. I mean, most of those sectors that you mentioned are probably from an older age group, and they have money normally.
Yeah, I mean, we call it the golden pound, right? So everything from hearing aids to mobility furniture, but also a lot of homeowners out there spending anywhere from 6,000 to 20,000 for a solar system. And these are, you know, up there with some of the biggest purchases you're ever going to make. So it only makes sense to make that experience easier for everybody along that journey. So yeah, absolutely. Very cash rich industry, something that's not going to go anywhere. And when you look at historic recessions, you know, touch wood, but I believe we're probably in it already and we're just seeing a lag in data. But when you look at historic recessions, comparison websites in particular favor very, very well, as well as Greggs, right? Everybody loves the sausage roll and everybody loves to compare the prices for things online and try to find the best deal. So we're going to be facilitating that in all of these areas which currently don't have that. And it's not just in the UK. You know, our ambition is to roll this out into the US, moving into next year. We've got enough demand to certainly match that. And then, across Europe and EMEA as well. So, we've got some lofty plans.
So who are your competitors, or aren't there any competitors?
There are. It's a really interesting niche space. Like I said, it's not the sexiest or most interesting area for a lot of technologists to be involved in. You know, people want to be working on really exciting areas, and this is something that's really important, but it's not Netflix, right? It's not a Google problem, so to speak. But competitor-wise, you've got companies like MBF Global, companies like Bridgepoint Private Equity, backed for $150 million debt facility, growth facility a number of years ago. And they're starting to stagnate. And, not only are we taking their customers at a rapid pace, but our eyes are set on the rest of their customers and the rest of their industries, as they've overgrown, in my opinion, and will struggle to pivot and struggle to change with the times. And it's incredible to see companies which are, 10 to 20 years old being disrupted already, because they're already too full of middle management and too full of tech debt, which they can't update quick enough. So companies like MBF on the older side, and certainly ones like Leads.io as well, based out of Europe, backed by Egeria Private Equity, another $200 million odd facility between debt and investment. We know the customers, we know who they're working with, we know the industries, and we know that there is this huge demand to move away from a model which really, really doesn't help consumers and it doesn't help brands. For perspective, those models consist of, you see something very clickbaity online, which says people over 50 can't believe how much they'll save when they buy new armbands for their narwhal trip. And they click on that advert, and then they go through and they give up all of their data. They give up all of their data. And at the end, it says someone's going to call you. And then all of a sudden, that data is dissected and sold off to multiple companies. All of a sudden, then the homeowner, and many people will be familiar with this, will be inundated with phone calls. A lot of older people in particular who get deceived by this practice, and then they end up with salespeople around their house before they know it, and they're overpaying for something which maybe they were just curious about in the first place. So, we're on a mission to make that easier, more transparent. We're seeing from the large energy companies that are signing up and have signed up to just launching with OVO at the moment, nationwide. And that is, they have not been able to make this sector work, lead generation work, historically, because they cannot risk their brand reputation by being overhanded with heavy sales tactics, not in this day and age. So our technology enables people and the consumers to make those decisions without feeling pressured, without being bombarded. And from what I can see, we're the only company doing that right now. And that's between the UK and the US and all of these sectors. You have companies on the other side, like Bark.com, where you can submit a Bark, but the companies using that platform aren't regulated. They have no association tie-ins. And the other side from us is we are making sure that the companies that work with us are reputable companies who are working with an association. So we're here to protect the consumers, but also work with businesses to, you know, hopefully increase the amount of revenue they're generating as well.
On that basis, how do you make revenue yourself then as a company through those processes?
So it's still through the method of gathering data and selling data fundamentally. It's down to somebody says, I want an inquiry from someone who's over 45, who lives within this region, who has a job. And we will match that person who's interested in a product or a service with said company. But the difference being that we provide the consumer the choice on who they receive their communication from, rather than saying, good luck, we've thrown you to the lions, someone's going to call you, and this, you're going to be called for, I don't know, 20 times a day for the next 2 years and until you buy. So our model is empowering the consumer, because then actually the business that we're working with has a higher pickup rate. The salespeople who are speaking to these individuals are having a better conversation, and everybody wins. You know, I don't see it as any losing scenario for either the consumer or the business. Both can benefit from this. And I think that's the most important thing.
Okay, very good. So tell me a little bit about SpotDiff then, and how that is going to impact Narwhal and the channels that you will be able to create from that website.
Yeah, so we're building out three core technology stacks right now as a company. So we have our front end, which is spotdiff.com, like you just mentioned. And that is like our comparison market. You know, people will be familiar with this one over the years. You sign up, you inquire about a product or service, and you can see a list of results from which you can then choose from. And it sounds really straightforward. It's actually very, very complicated doing all of that waiting and algorithm, but creating a system which allows that to work. Probably why nobody's done it in these sectors before. Then we have the middleware, and the middleware is the invisible brains and AI that's powering everything. And that's going, this person is far more likely to appreciate the offer of this company over this one. So we're going to prioritize this company above the other one. And that's not just done on how much a company's bidding, like in Google Ads, for that lead or inquiry, but also based on if they are more likely to need finance. And if so, how many dependents do they have in the household? And all of that matching technology and the brains is being done by that middleware. And then we've got the backend sign-up flow for the small companies out there. So obviously I mentioned we work with these large, big national companies, energy companies and so on. But we also work with small installers. You know, the average auto installer or electrician can sign up and add their payment card details, click on an interactive map of the areas that they want to buy leads from. They don't have to pay any setup fee to get going. They literally just say, I want 5 inquiries a day. And they will then pay for those 5 inquiries every single day. So we see this as for certainly those companies, a way from which they can run digital marketing at fixed cost without them having to go, oh God, you know, yesterday it cost me £200 an inquiry on Google. Well, the most you'll ever pay working with us is that fixed price that you agree when you sign up and go for that system. So yeah, those are the main three tech stacks. And for us now, it's all about unifying all of those different solutions into one main package from which then we can roll out globally in different languages, different tax regimes, et cetera.
Okay. So is there a situation where you are likely to go down the line where you will actually supply some of these products yourself, as in, you know, that Narwhal will own some of the products in the maybe smaller niches so that they can be done well?
Yeah, quite possibly. You know, there's certainly routes where we can partner with existing industries, but I believe the way that we'll be heading will be to really, really hone in and continue to focus and double down on building out this technology stack internally. A, because it's proprietary technology. We're not leasing this technology from third parties. We're building it all in-house, which has a huge amount of value associated with it. As I mentioned earlier, you have big global competitors who have failed to do this after 100 million of funding in 10 years, and we're already leaping ahead of them in terms of the technical ability of what we're able to accomplish. So, you know, we're going to carry on pushing that and driving that forward, because that's the urban goal right now. We know that we can quite easily, I believe, once rolled out into the US in particular, be achieving 10 million per month recurring revenue, which will be growing exponentially year on year. And I don't see a path where we don't achieve those numbers at this current rate, because every single large company that we're speaking to, you know, wants to work with us tomorrow. And I think that's because of the competitive landscape of digital advertising right now. It's very, very tough out there. And to have assurances of having something predictable coming in is very useful for CFOs, chief of sales, and CEOs globally right now.
Yeah, if I knew as a salesperson 20 years ago, I was getting a lead from somebody who really did want me to speak to them, as opposed to just a name and a number, I would be a million times happier to ring the person, and the person would be much more open to speaking to me, whether to visit me or not, is the case.
Yeah, and you know, we're even trying to disrupt ourselves already in terms of other development internally by starting to look at creating conversational artificial intelligence, which will be able to do that calling. So there's already a huge amount of money being put into the replacement of call centers in particular. You can imagine, and you know, I like to refer to this as the Uber scenario. You know, Uber makes profit when there's no drivers. And you get to know drivers by Uber training, well, Uber's drivers training its self-driving proposition. And you know, it's very similar with call centers. You have call recordings, you have a huge amount of data, which just needs to be transcribed, boxed up, and then put into a large language model. And quite quickly, you know, I think within 6 months, we're going to see this huge change where you're not having call centers anymore, and you're having personalized conversational AI doing that heavy lifting. And you'll see a lot of jobs go from it, but we're focusing on working with the right reps to train these models with personality in niche areas. So it's not going to be one model that does everything. You're going to have a model which can handle windows and doors inquiries, or solar panel inquiries, or a whole array of different choices, and each one's going to have to be custom. So the people who create those models will be like the early creators of websites on the internet. You know, this is a whole platform to build upon. Most people worry about, it's going to take my job, but actually it's going to create a huge amount of wealthy people if they create the right things right now.
So it's a very interesting concept, and you've said already that the guys who grew quickly are almost a bit like dinosaurs, if that's the right way to look at it. So I suppose the question that I came up with in my head is, how is Narwhal not going to become a dinosaur in the next 3 to 5 years? You know, how are they going to manage to do it? I mean, we could say, oh yes, AI will just take us there, but how is it going to happen? What's your vision in terms of that?
I mean, kind of, like I just mentioned, I think trying to disrupt yourself, and I'm a keen chess player. And if you can see 8 moves ahead of where the direction of the pieces are going, and you can mitigate those risks before the outcome arrives, then you're going to be in a good position. The other key one here is not overexpanding rapidly with humans. Many of these companies have hired thousands of employees, and with that comes middle management, comes bloat, becomes red tape and bureaucracy and slow down, whereas we're able to be agile. You know, we can go out, speak to our customers, and we're building custom solutions always for them dynamically. And this is one of the big frustrations with a couple of the big, large national and international finance institutions that we've just signed up. Hopefully on the next call, one of the legal gump will be done, and we'll be able to announce who those companies are. But their biggest frustration with the incumbent players is that they are so rigid. And for a company that's 10 years old to be very rigid isn't a great sign for its futures, especially when, you know, they're laying off 30% of their staff and they're in retreat and they haven't solved the problems that we've solved. They're reliant on salespeople to have a huge volume of signups, whereas we have a self-service pay-as-you-go platform, which we can just run, you know, automatically and sign up hundreds of customers without the need for humans. account managers, we've already trained an AI account manager who can do most of the heavy lifting 24 hours a day in any language, not by a voice, but certainly by a text, by the platform itself. So we're already creating these solutions for problems that don't exist yet. And I think that's really important, especially with the rate change this is happening. You know, people go, you know, this AI stuff is comparable to the birth of the internet. No, it is. It's like the internet, but it's maybe a 50 to 100 times faster rollout. You know, it's much, much faster than people are giving it credit for.
Yeah, no, we're seeing it more and more, even when you're searching on the internet, that you get bot chats and you're getting your questions answered and they're doing whatever needs to be done.
I think they asked for a call to be slowed down, didn't they? Elon wanted it to be paused for 6 months, didn't he? Because he was concerned of, as you say, how rapid the growth and the speed of it was. And I think he just had dialogue with Rishi this week, didn't he? And he predicted a future where AI would render work optional. He didn't say completely obsolete, but more of like a co-pilot type existence, which was interesting.
Yeah, I don't see a future where that isn't the case. And I think most people are keeping their heads in the sand about that outcome will continue to. You know, it's a bit like the early days when I watched a video recently where the Burger King introduced credit card payments for the first time. And the news outlet went in and said, you know, will you be putting your burger on a credit card? And everyone was outraged, going, no, this is ridiculous. Why would you pay for credit on for a burger? And lo and behold, you know, eventually everybody adopts it and everybody moves forward with it. You know, the first people to watch a video on the internet was watching a coffee pot. And it was an engineer who set up a coffee pot live stream so that in the other room, he could see when the coffee was ready and he could go in. That first video had tens of thousands of views, whereas everybody else said the internet won't catch on. So, you know, it is essentially that, but people don't realize that it's being trained rapidly, even as we speak. You know, if you look at EE call centers in particular, IBM Watson was working with EE for probably over 10 years on call recordings, training data to eventually make call centers obsolete and replace them with conversational AI. So these are things that are already happening. They're just not being openly talked about because actually there's a huge detrimental effect on society if you're on the wrong end of that curve.
Yeah, I mean, what about AI podcasts about shares?
Right? Yeah, we're in trouble. Well, you guys certainly are.
Is it coming?
Yeah, I think, you know, Kev's replaceable with an AI robot, but I'm not sure about no.
Well, there's no evidence that Kev is human anyway, so it's questionable.
Absolutely.
I hoped one day somebody replaced.
He's not a sentient being, is he, Luke?
Not that I've seen. No.
Yeah.
And then that people can blame the AI robot then instead of me. That would be good.
Very good.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the financial situation then. I know you've had big news this week in terms of an appointment. So yeah, tell us a little bit about that and what's likely to be happening over the next quarter or two.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been in talks with couple of investment banks for a number of months now, and we're pleased to announce to our investors and staff today that we've appointed Pamela Gordon to go and work with us on our next round. It's a round which will hopefully propel us into the US and global, and that will entail, you know, raising circa $20 million on a $80 million pre-money, $100 million post-money valuation to get us in a position where we can finally become that narwhal or unicorn in you know, a couple of years' time, which is what I'm hoping to achieve from all of this. We've been working with analysts for a number of months, and you know, we believe that we can demand 10 times annual revenue, between 8 to 12 on the revenue that's flowing through our platform. We believe that the growth is obvious enough to attract some of the larger investors, and some of those we've already had some early conversations with, and it's a lot of excitement around what we're doing. Sometimes it's the really unsexy things which you know, get the attention when the markets are tough, because certain things don't go away. You know, people are going to be having solar panels. People are going to continue buying heat pumps. The government have to, you know, make this a reality, and they are. So it's not going to go anywhere, and we're going to be at the forefront of making that happen, working alongside 90% of all of the major energy companies in the UK, working with all of the big brands, from everything from solar panels to home electricity to EV chargers and the rest of that journey, which people will be going on over the next 5 to 10 years.
So from just using your own figures from before, having moved into the US, 10 million a month revenue in terms of this lead generation and other revenues that you managed to generate, you believe is very achievable. This is 120 million a year. And you times that by the same figure that you're talking about. You're talking about £1.2 billion valuation. That's pretty lofty.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, I have to pinch myself and go, what am I missing here? Where if I don't pull this off, like, you know, what is it that I'm not getting? And, you know, I get the leadership team for the company around the table and I'm saying the same things. And we're all looking at the projections going, no, if we execute all of these things, which we believe are very, very achievable in terms of rolling out, especially due to how fast we built what we built and have proven that model. I don't see a scenario where we don't reach that lofty valuation and beyond. And this is doing a very base level, generating a lead or some data that's selling it X amount of times. That's without the huge amount of data that we're gathering on engagement and how people interact with different adverts. And everything else which is proprietary owned data. It's also not without the other ways that we can cut it. So we are, as part of this kind of bigger mission, folding in our other products and services within our central service. So people will be able to sign up to our cybersecurity tools. People will be able to sign up to our website optimization self-service software that we built a number of years ago. So finally, everything's coming centrally within the universe, and we can, you know, very clearly see how this is going to roll out. So yeah, I'm very confident that providing we stay well capitalized, which I, you know, we're in a very healthy position right now. We've got over 2 million in the bank. And yeah, you know, there's negligible cash burn apart from R&D, from which, you know, comes back the generous schemes in the UK. I don't see a scenario where we don't do it, but I think the key thing is doing it right. You know, there's a lot of companies doing it badly, and we've got one shot to, you know, solve it for everybody, which is you solve this pain for the consumer, which will keep the brand sticky in their brain. You solve pain for the big nationals who don't work with our rivals anymore because they've been so stung in the past with reputation issues. And you solve a problem for the small independent companies as well. And you know, we can see over the last week to 2 weeks, what happens to these large nationals when they get it wrong. You know, SafeStyle was one of our largest customers since records began on our side. And, you know, obviously they went bust overnight and it was game over. And to see our model kick into play, i.e. we've got other big national windows and doors companies. SafeStyle were the biggest, but we do have others. And we've got these smaller regional ones buying up the volume. It means that the actual overall impact is fairly negligible at scale. And that shows the robustness of if you're heading into a recession, you need to make sure that you have that kind of triangle or pyramid. You should never mention the word pyramid when it comes to business, but I always seem to end up saying it. So you got your pyramid of customers, right? So you've got your small customers at the bottom, and that's your stable base. And, you know, Kevin, you're familiar with Egypt, so I'm sure you'll be able to tell me all about this. And then you've got your large, big brands at the top, and they're like the star at the top that's attracting all of these smaller customers, because if you're working with them, they want to work with you as well. And creating that whole group together, that's the model, and that's so far what we're doing. You know, some of our advisors said, look, what has to be true for you to move into a new sector? It's bear in mind, we've only worked in three sectors over the last few months, and we're just about to roll out another 42 right now. From which we're already plowing into very quickly. And the thing that has to be true is we have to have somebody on a big national scale taking the large majority of leads. It's like a cash and carry. We're advertising at a large scale. We're generating those leads cheaper because we're advertising at a large scale. And then we're passing that saving on to small businesses and national companies alike. So.
Okay, very good. It all sounds very exciting. And talking to you before many times and talking to you today, I know that your brain is not going to let this sort of not happen, because you want to achieve something that has not been achieved before. And I think that's what's quite exciting about this whole thing. And you've encouraged many other people, I think, to come along on your on the journey, if you like, to make the thing as productive and I think technologically advanced as possible at this moment in time. Though we don't see it, obviously, there is this middle bit, which is the technology that actually is going to drive this thing forward. You know, you're going to be able to do this, I presume, all from Bristol without huge numbers of people. You know, you're going to need more and more people, but not as many as the competitors because of the work that you've done. So I wish you luck. Obviously, we're investors, so we want you to do well. And a lot of people who will be listening will be investors. But if people who aren't investors wish to invest with yourselves, how can they do it?
They can reach out. And, you know, we're not actively seeking now for any personal capital or from individuals. We've been really lucky today. You know, we haven't taken venture capital money. So we're very much in our own destiny right now, which is fantastic. And while capitalized at the same time. But obviously, moving it forward with Pamela Gordon, we're going to be going after the much larger entities out there to get one or two tickets rather than, you know, 70. So certainly people can reach out. We can, especially for value add investors, there's always a space at the table. We've got a really great team of people who've provided huge amounts of insights and who have been like my personal Yodas to me over the last couple of years. And without them, then, you know, there's no way that it's all possible. It's not just about the money. It's about all of the knowledge that comes with it. And being able to take all of that on board is so super important. But yeah, absolutely. They can reach out to Sunday Roast if they wish to and get in touch with you, Kevin. And we can talk about it on our boat out in the icebergs.
Indeed. And I mean, the other interesting thing is hopefully there's going to be people in the IT industry listening to this, is that, you know, if you're interested in an exciting new opportunity, then, you know, tap, look up and see, because there's going to be opportunities, I'm sure, going forward as you move forward.
I think the important thing is, and, you know, I'm quite a brutal realist with this, is that 70-80% of all coding jobs are going to be gone within the next couple of years. So if you're focused on I'm irreplaceable, then I wouldn't bother reaching out. Whereas if you're a realist and understand the way that this is heading and are willing to adopt AI technology to almost give yourself a superhuman ability, you know, one man or one woman doing the work of 100, you know, those are the people I want to speak to. So yeah, but yeah, absolutely, Kevin.
Very good.
Okay.
We'll say on that note, Luke Sartain, CEO and founder of Narwhal Media Group, thanks very much for your time.
Cheers, guys. Take care.
Thanks, Luke.
Well, that was a bit of a marathon roast, wasn't it? It was good to chat to those guys. Should we just quickly move on to some market, the movers and shakers of the week?
Yeah. Is there rumors galore going on out there, is there not? I mean, we've got rumors for Contango, we got rumors for, or maybe it wasn't a rumor actually, it was an actual bid for MCM. I think it
was. Yeah, MCM had a bid, didn't they, in the week? That was looking good.
Yeah, if you add Ben to that, you've got three coal miners with the potential, I think, to have some sort of situation going on, so we will see.
Yeah, there was Prospects Energy as well, obviously, who had the Selva Field development update, Q3 2023 operation update, with more than 5.6 million SCM gas produced and sold to BP Gas Marketing. We caught up with Mark Routh, CEO, in the week and did a midweek takeaway podcast. So if you're a holder of that one or interested in that one, then have a look on your Audio Boom or on Spotify for that episode. It was a good chat this week, wasn't it, with Mark?
Yeah, very good. And I think that company's going places. I think it'll be pretty good over the next year or two.
And then obviously we also did a podcast with Alex Stanbury, didn't we, from Technology Minerals. There was an acquisition update earlier in the week.
Yeah, things seem to be coming together, so we will see how that all pans out. Let's hope it sticks to its time frame and we get the recycler situation put together so that it can move on as a recycler, which I think is where the money's going to be at.
Good. Well, I think we've talked long enough. Is there anything else you want to cover before we sign off?
Not off. It's been very interesting talking to our guests today. And we would like to welcome them both on again, I think, in the not too distant future. So, very interesting.
Just if you like what you heard, hit the subscribe icon or hit the subscribe button and the bell icon, and you'll be given updates on any future releases. Thanks very much for listening. Hope you survive Storm Kieran.
Yeah, thanks for listening, guys.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of the Sunday Roast,
please email admin@thesundayroast.net.